This is Tea Earl Grey Hot, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. Stormfront Part 2. Welcome to Tea Earl Grey Hot, Episode 2. My name is Yannick, I'm the French guy from Switzerland. And joining me tonight, as always, my friend and co-host Dave. Good evening, Dave.
Good evening, Yannick. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And we are very thrilled to have a guest, our first guest on this show. From TuxDigital.com, also co-host of Destination Linux and co-host of many other shows and contributors to many open source projects. That's Michael Tonnell. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks to be here. I mean, it's the first time we have a guest. We don't even know what we're doing. So thank you for being there. So, Dave, what have you been up to this last week?
Well, apart from watching Star Trek Enterprise, not a lot really. I've been off this week so far with the children's bank holiday. My lovely wife has just celebrated her 40th birthday, so we've been celebrating that appropriately.
Happy birthday, Caroline!
Absolutely. But apart from that, nothing really kind of geeky to report as yet. We're still in the process of sorting out the improvements on our house. So, not really much to report on that side, I'm afraid.
Right. And Michael, have you been up to something close to Star Trek this past few weeks?
Yes, actually. Every once in a while, probably every few years or so, I'll binge watch a series from Star Trek. And this past, a couple months, I've been binge watching Deep Space Nine. Yeah. And I think I'm on about season 5 now or something like that. So, I'll probably do it again in a couple years from now, but like it's essentially like, because if there's nothing new, I'll watch something anyway. And even if there is something new, I'll still go back and watch some of the other ones.
Yeah, I understand this. I do that also. I'm watching Next Gen at the moment. Did you have the opportunity to see What We Left Behind, the Deep Space Nine documentary?
No, unfortunately, I haven't been able to see that. I do want to see that, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it's not available in Europe, I think, right now. So when it comes out, I'm going to watch that and, we'll do a review probably.
Nice.
Right, talking about review, we're going to review Stormfront Part 2. That's episode 2 from the season 4 of Star Trek Enterprise. So Dev and Michael, feel free to join in whenever you have something to say. This is obviously the follow-up of the first episode. It starts, however, with something totally unexpected for me. That's a black and white newsreel, the kind of propaganda movies that could be in during the war period. Relates the visit of the German chancellor to New York. Everybody's happy and everything is great, and the visit ends up with a talk to the city officials where the chancellor says that he's going to work with America to make the country a great nation again. So after the credits, we are in the White House, still semi-destroyed, wearing the colors of the Reich. There's the German official from the previous episode. I believe we still don't know his name.
Now, I did look into this because in my notes, I was getting fed up with using the word German general all the time. And I did look it up. And actually, in IMDb, he is credited as German general.
All right. So the German general and Voske are arguing about the squadron. The German officer wants it deployed immediately, but Vosk is not really happy about that. Both threatens the other one, and Vosk ends up telling that he is very, very powerful and that he can erase the German officer from history if he ever feels the urge to threaten him again, which leaves us with a speechless. And I believe it shows fear at that moment when Vosk walks out of the room.
Yes, I think he was definitely afraid in that moment for sure.
As it was the case with last week's episode, this one goes back and forth between the Enterprise and what's going on Earth. So we're back now on the Enterprise, where Alicia and Archer have a discussion. He tells Alicia that he can send her anywhere in the world, but she chooses to go back to her neighborhood to help other peoples. Archer tells her that Trip and Travis are missing, so she offers to put the word out and try to look at them. Alicia then tells Archer that he could wipe the Germans off the face of the planet with the power of the Enterprise, but of course he refuses, and he said that he's going to do that another way. We're back in Vosk's lab. He and his new lieutenant agree on the fact that the Enterprise crew are not temporal agents. They run another test of the conduit, but once again it fails. Vosk then admits that he doesn't trust the Germans and he's never going to give them any weapon. He doesn't want to give them something that they can use against him. And then he asks that the prisoners get medical attention. The sequence ends with Silic crawling on the ceiling of the cell and falling on Trip's face.
So I detected a real change in Vosk's approach of the prisoners at this point, because it seemed to be that he's gone from, you know, wanting to experiment on them and test on them to find out the information he needs to know, whereas now he seems to want to protect them, to preserve them for something, by assigning them back to where they were secured, sending a doctor for them so that they could be looked after. And this seemed like a real change of approach for Vosk.
Yeah, even his relationship with the Germans, I think it changed in this episode. On the first episode, it was more, you know, I need them, I need those things. But now, there's an urgency, maybe.
I think he realized he was losing control of the situation, so then he needed to adjust.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah, but to be fair, if that was the case and he did think he was losing control, then I would have expected his response to have been actually the opposite of wanting to, you know, turn into a nice person. I would expect it to go around and just basically obliterate everything in sight.
Well, I think he's also mostly lying. So, like, he's saying that he has, like, all this power and he can do all these things, but he needs all this stuff from them to be able to do any of the things that he says he can do. So without that stuff, he really can't. And he's realizing that it's very soon that the Germans are going to be sick of giving him stuff because he's not following through. And he's making adjustments with the prisoners in order to, you know, basically just have a different approach to it, because otherwise it's going to blow up in his face.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe at that point, I'm sure he can't do anything. Except the trying to open the conduit, and then maybe he could do something. But if the German was to capture him right now, he couldn't do anything. Yeah. Well, next we're back on the Enterprise, where Malcolm found out that someone assassinated Lenin in 1916, setting up a chain of events that lead to the current situation. T'Pol points out that Vosk and his men only arrived a few years ago, so he could not be responsible for the death of Lenin. Malcolm says that Lenin's assassin was never caught and, according to some witnesses, vanished into thin air. Archer says that it's the chicken and the egg situation, so probably that Vosk will be responsible for that in the past later on. Time travel is such a mess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing about Lenin being assassinated in 1916, I mean, we were talking about a 28-year gap between 1916 and 1944, where they are at the moment. But actually, when you think about it, it's not a 28-year gap. It's, you know, it could be 28 minutes, 28 hours, because if someone is going through time, changing things in the way that is necessary, all you've got to do is set something in motion in 1916 and then hop forward to 1944 to see what's happened. If that hasn't worked, go back again, try again until it actually works. So this 28-year elapsed period, it isn't.
I found that kind of funny when they were saying, like, there's no way they could have done this. Like, they can travel through time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Archer is called to the bridge as Oshii receives a transmission from Vosk. And he proposes to discuss with Archer in a neutral place about the prisoners. Archer is skeptical and points out that Vosk was willing to kill him not too long ago. Vosk says that the situation has changed and gives Archer an hour before the meeting. So that's the explanation for why the prisoners were suddenly very important to that is the beginning of the explanation. So back on Earth, Archer beams down with two armed security men. Vosk shows up, surrenders the prisoners. Archer sends them back to the ship and stays behind to talk with Vosk. He wants to know what Archer knows about him. The captain tells him pretty much everything he knows and pretty much everything we know. Vosk says that it's only one side of the story and that Daniels and his group are a tyrannical sect. I think that's what he uses. Mm. Imposing their will on other creatures through the timeline, manipulating it for their own good. When Archer says Vosk is no different, he replies that at least he doesn't hide his intentions. He goes on saying that time travel technology is no different than the one of a warp drive and should be utilized to the benefit of all species to improve them through careful manipulation of historical events.
I absolutely loved that quote.
Yeah.
Societies and cultures can be improved through careful manipulation of historical events. Because it doesn't just apply to time travel, it also applies to the whole concept of propaganda. And if you've read 1984, George Orwell's book, then it's all done through the manipulation of historical events to change the past, not physically change the past, but change the documented history of the past to yield a completely different outcome.
Yeah, and Archer starts asks the correct questions. He says, "Who is to decide what needs to be changed?" Mm. And Vosk immediately says that he's not going to be drawn into a philosophical debate.
Yeah, yeah. I don't like that question, so I'm not going to answer it.
Yes, that's it. Yes. So back in Sigbay, Phlox conducts a medical exam of the prisoners. He hands a tablet to Archer, who starts acting strange around trip.
Mm.
Yeah. Phlox discreetly presses a button somewhere and Archer, Trip and Travis continue the debriefing until Trip attacks the captain. They fight and then Trip, who is in fact Silic, escapes but is incapacitated by the security guards.
The big giveaway there was that he did exactly the same thing with Archer as he did with Trip in the last episode. He did this kind of slinky, head-shrinky thing and managed to get out of Archer's clutches.
Yeah.
And it's like,
I have to admit, I didn't see that coming.
No, I didn't. Obviously, when Phlox showed the tablet to Archer, I'm thinking that, I don't know, maybe there was something there that they'd been infected with something or they'd been implanted with something. But it wasn't until Phlox, I think what Phlox did is he actually used his communicator, the communicator in sickbay, to contact security or the bridge or something. Yeah. Which that kind of caught me out actually, because usually when anybody uses a communicator in a room, the ones on the wall, you can hear what's being said, but clearly that wasn't the case in this instance.
Maybe he has a silent alarm button.
That's entirely possible.
Yeah. He could have been just like making a statement and not wanting them to respond. So he could just say it quietly so that they just recognize it and don't respond and just come.
Yeah, there's probably a code for that. But then again, the button itself still made the bleeping noise that it normally makes.
Yeah. But you don't know why it was broken at this moment. Conveniently.
Yeah, yeah.
Plot device.
Yeah. Back on Earth, Alicia turns to Carmine's wound and Sal's death is confirmed. Carmine says that there's a rumor that Alicia and Archer disappeared into thin air just before they got caught, but she replies that it's crazy. He says that he didn't believe it either, but he didn't believe in German Martians before he saw one, so he doesn't buy it. He then pulls a communicator out of his pocket and asks Alicia what it is. She says that it's a radio to talk to Archer, and Carmine wants to know where he is.
I actually really like the mafia aspect to the episode of the combo show. Like, I like this part where they're the people who are, you know, providing the manpower to make it possible to fight back are the mafia that are considered like the organized crime of the prior to that. I think that's a pretty interesting approach to it because it gives you a different perspective of what they're doing, because they're doing it because they feel like they have the power to be involved, and they're actually going through the process of having like the ethical and moral requirement of themselves to do so.
I can't help thinking though that although the gangsters or the goons, as we were calling them, they do provide a certain element of comic relief to the episode.
Yeah.
They also seem to carry the stereotypes you would expect from your typical American gangsters, where you've got the lead dude who is not particularly intelligent, but he knows how to sort of keep his men under control. You've got the muscly one that just goes around and shouts and points and prods at anything he can. You've got the not very intelligent one that's like, duh, I'm just a bit of muscle. And it just kind of reinforces the stereotype. Was it Wacky Races? The anthill mob. It's almost like that. And I just found that incredibly amusing. And I think it did actually make a really good contribution to this episode, well, to this pair of episodes.
Yeah, I wish they actually would have given more information to the new leader of the mafia group.
Come on,
because it doesn't matter. That I mean, they're going to reset the timeline anyway, so who cares?
Yeah,
and you're talking to this guy, and he's like, okay, I wouldn't have believed in a Martian before with like red eyes and stuff. And I wouldn't believe that any of this stuff is possible. But now that I'm aware that this could be possible, I'm asking you, like, just give me the information. And they refuse to do it. And it's like, well, at this point, it's not like you can take the bottle, take the information out of the bottle and put it back in or whatever. Because, like, he already knows that aliens exist. A transporter technology wouldn't be that shocking in comparison.
But I believe Alicia did tell him because... The scene ends with Carmine saying, "You've been a little sister to us for so long. Are you going to keep secrets now?" And then I believe that she tells everything after that. It's not just on camera.
Well, later on, later on in the show, that there's another time where he starts asking questions and they don't do it. Yeah. So I assume that they didn't this time.
Back on the Enterprise, Silik is in the brig. Archer comes to visit and asks many questions to which Silik won't answer. There's a discussion between both of them, and Silik ends up Silik denies everything that Archer says, but he implies that he knows where Trip is. So back on Earth again, Trip is in a small room, probably where Silik hid him. Vosk calls the Enterprise to tell Archer that a large amount of data was stolen. Archer informs Vosk that the thief is Sullivan, that's Silik. He was carrying a device with a lot of data about the complex. Both parties threaten each other by playing "My gun is bigger than yours." Vosk wants to answer an answer to his proposal, which Archer turns down. Vosk then shots his plasma cannon to the Enterprise. The Enterprise returns fire, but retreats out of range of the plasma cannon. Malcolm informs Archer that the engines are down. Archer asks Tipple to analyze the stolen data to find a way to disable the compound's shields. And then he goes back to the brig to see Silik. He tells him they are both going to get Trip back. Silik accepts, but only because Archer plans on destroying The Compound.
Sorry, just quickly jumping back to the exchange of fire between the Enterprise and the Compound. I don't know how I feel about watching what are essentially bullets, you know, large bore bullets being shot from the fighters. You actually saw them going through the bridge.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know whether that was actually what we were seeing or whether it was some other consequence of being fired at. But it did seem to me as though the bullets were literally going up through the top of the hull, through the bridge, and then back out through the bottom again. Now, clearly their shields aren't working, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But if that was the case, if there was some kind of technical or a damage-related reason that the shields weren't up, then why then was there not a pressure issue on the hull? I know they were quite close to Earth at this point, but I would have thought that still at the height they were above the Earth's surface, they would have suffered from pressure issues.
Yeah, well, there's a tradition in Star Trek that each time a ship gets hit, there's explosions and things falling on the bridge, and it doesn't really make sense. I mean,
Yeah. Also, when things explode, it doesn't matter because everything's still working, and then they have replacements in there.
Yeah.
It's like, I got this
now. The shields
now.
Are down!
Well, shields are rarely completely down, you know, they're like 37%. How can an energy shield be 77% down? I don't know.
Although, to be fair, they don't have shields yet, do they? It's hull plating.
Yes.
Yes.
Polarize the
hull plating, that's right.
Yeah, that's right, next, T'Pol found a way to disable the shield from inside, so Archer tells her to give them 10 minutes after the shields are down to destroy the complex. T'Pol points out that the targeting arrays are down. Archer tells her that she has to do what she can. Now, dressed as civilians, Archer and Silic beam down. So we're back in Vosk's facility, where the German officer comes bearing direct orders from the Führer to take command of the squadron. Vosk asks for 6 hours to prepare the weapon. Once the German officer has left, Vosk tells his lieutenant to begin preparations for their departure. Meanwhile, Trip manages to escape. There's one point here that I don't know if it's just me, but I don't think that we know what the squadron is at this moment.
I don't think it matters. I don't think it's actually relevant to the storyline necessarily. I appreciate that, you know, we're in a war setting, so the only thing I can think of is that they're still trying to play out World War II, despite the fact of what we're observing from our particular viewpoint.
Yeah, I think they're implying that the squadron is the aliens and their technology.
Oh, okay, right, okay. I misinterpreted that then, if that's the case.
I'm not sure if that's what they mean, but it's what it feels like, because they're always talking about how, like, Vosk will say something like, the squadron's staying with me or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I believe we see exactly what the squadron is later in the episode. Okay.
What I did notice at this point is that the level of frustration that is being displayed by the German general is very much reaching its peak.
Yeah.
I, despite what we know in later scenes, I think he has absolutely reached the end of his limit.
And when Vosk asks for 6 hours, he's really pissed off.
Yeah, oh, totally.
So Archer and Silic, who changed his yellowish skin to an ordinary human one, are walking in the street at night, avoiding being seen. They end up rejoining with Alicia and Carmine. We are back on the Enterprise, where Hoshi and Malcolm detect what could be an ally attack. T'Pol asks for a status report, then learns the engine are only 36% up and still no targeting array. So what's 30% up? I don't know. I don't know.
Well, all science fiction does something like that. Yes. They're saying these things and like, how are you? What would be 100%? Okay, everything's working, but when is everything working anyway?
Never, surely.
Yeah.
On Earth, Archer explains to Carmine that the facility is a weapon manufacturer. Carmine is not convinced he should help Archer, but Alicia says that she will and ask Carmine whether or not he wants to help her.
So that particular scene, I loved the fact that Silic was struggling with the dialect. And there was a bit of a front off between Carmine and Silic. And Silic didn't quite understand exactly what was going on here. And the case in point, which I found incredibly funny, I actually laughed out loud at this one, was when Silic said, "Are you threatening me?" to Carmine. Carmine said, "We'll give the man a prize." To which Silic said, "Why would you do that?"
Yeah.
That was a data response, not a...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I like that too. That was really good. This is also the scene where he asks about the stuff again and they don't tell him. And it's kind of like, you just help me because I'm going to help him, so you're going to help me. It's like, well, just tell him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice character. I liked him. So in the complex, Vosk addresses his people. Carmine and his men ram the complex's fence with a car. Bullets start flying in both directions. Archer and Silic manage to get inside the complex. Alicia arrives to help Carmine hold the Germans off. Vosk tells his lieutenant to let the Germans deal with that and then continue preparations.
When they were coming in to the thing and Alicia helps... What was she doing? What were the rest of them doing in the first place?
I have no clue.
it was just weird. Like, oh, I'm so happy to see you. It's like, why weren't they there in the first place? Because they weren't apparently doing anything other than that. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yes. So, Archer signals that he is almost at the console, and Tipple responds the Enterprise is going to have to get closer to shoot at the complex. Archer manages to deactivate the shields, and then the Enterprise dives into the atmosphere.
Yannick, have we missed a scene?
Which one?
So before the point where the compound is breached by the car, there was a scene where Vosk was like riling up his race mates,
yeah.
Saying that there was only one enemy left in their way. Trip was seen hovering in the background, having a listen to what was going on. And then Vosk said something quite important, which he said the words, "My brothers, we are going home."
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot to put that in. Right. Yes.
That was the where he was doing the speech about how they have like they're entitled to this thing or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I call the knitting a flag speech.
Yes. Yeah, sorry about that.
No.
So, yes, the Enterprise dives into the atmosphere and there's more shooting between Archer and some German soldiers. Silic asks for a weapon, but Archer responds that he only has one. All of a sudden, Silic has disappeared, only to reappear, falling on two German soldiers and stealing their weapons.
He got his weapon that way.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I thought he was he escaped or something, but no, he was still there. Hmm. Unfortunately for Silic, a third soldier shoots him in the back multiple times, and then Archer does something that I didn't really expect from him. He shoots the soldier.
Yes,
but Silic is in really bad shape. Vosk lieutenant announces that the Enterprise has entered the atmosphere. Vosk wants to deploy the squadron. But the German officer arrives at this moment and objects that the squadron is going to the front. When the German officer tells Vosk that he's taking command of the facility, Vosk just kills him in cold blood and also two German soldiers. Archer tries to contact the Enterprise to beam Silic up, but they can't receive the transmission. Silic, who now has recovered his appearance, dies in Archer's arm. I struggle with my H's tonight. Trip arrives at the scene, but he thinks that Archer is Silic, so he points a gun at him. Archer shows him Silic's body, and Trip realizes his mistake. and all is well, and Archer is not dead.
Yes.
Yeah, that was really out of character for Archer to just shoot that German soldier.
I think at this stage, Archer was thinking that, you know, he and Cilic were actually on the same side, which in respect they were. I think it was just a defense response.
Yeah.
I think, they're in a war and he knows that you're trying to kill him. So it's kind of like, you kind of have a choice, no choice to do it.
No, I was wondering if it was, maybe Kurt would have done that, but I'm not sure Picard would have done something like that. I don't know.
It depends. If there was a gun pointed at him, I think the thing happened too quickly, I didn't pick up on it. But if there was a gun pointed at him at that particular moment in time, then yeah. I think Archer's response would have been absolutely spot on. But as I say, it happened too quickly for me to take in that particular piece of detail.
Well, let's give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Oh, it wasn't a murder, definitely.
No.
Definitely.
No.
The death of Cilic, he said something really quite out of character. He said, "I would have preferred fighting you, but this will suffice."
Yeah, something.
And then he died. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But effectively just pointing out that, you know, we were never meant to work together, but, you know, that we did. Yeah, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, it's an interesting character twist a little bit too. Because he's mostly just been completely evil the entire time. And then all of a sudden he's like, well, in this new perspective that I have working with you, you know, it's pretty interesting.
The fact that he was working with Archer in the first place, it doesn't really make sense to me. You know, everything he has done has been against the ideals and the ethics that Archer holds to.
Well, they talk about that when they're walking down the street before they get, you know, meeting all those other people. They're walking down the street and they have the conversation about how they, like, Vos, what Vosk wants to do is not exactly like. His race wants to have control, but he can't let another race take control over the whatever. Yeah. Because if they were to do that, then it would basically mean that everyone loses because they would basically try to be dominant over everyone. And he knows that while he doesn't really want to work with them, that's the only option he has because he is stuck in a cell. So he basically is just taking what is given to him.
Yeah, I believe it's a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Is my friend, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if to some extent it's also to do with the fact that he's adopting a human form. I know he's a shapeshifter anyway, but being in a human form, maybe he is actually adopting some of the human sensibilities.
Maybe.
As a side effect.
I don't know, but it was nice to see him. Yeah, I actually see the actor with his proper face.
Yeah.
All right. So now the Enterprise is still 100 kilometers away from the complex, but still can't get a lock. So Malcolm switches to visual targeting. Archer rejoins Carmine and Alicia, and they all fall back. Alicia tells Archer to fix everything so she can get her neighborhood back and her husband back. The Enterprise is then attacked by German bombers, and I believe that's the squadron, actually. Malcolm thinks that the Enterprise doesn't have anything to worry about, but in fact, the bombers have been retrofitted with laser cannons, and they are actually making damage to the Enterprise.
I think I might have jumped the gun on my comment about the bullets going through the hull. I think that was this scene, okay. Not the scene before. Okay. Sorry about that.
So in that case, the Enterprise is in the atmosphere, so they wouldn't suffer any pressure problem. Archer enters the bridge and asks for photonic torpedoes. So here I have a problem with that. The Enterprise is in the atmosphere, flying at about 200 kilometers per hour. And while they cannot communicate, they were able to beam him on board. So there's something. Well, I'm going to come back on that because I have.
They're different frequencies. Let's just play with this.
Yeah. Okay. let's. But so they're different frequencies, and they can lock on Archer to beam him, but they can't lock on the complex to target torpedoes. Anyway.
Another frequency problem.
Yeah. So inside the facility.
Well, remember, there was only 36% ready.
Yes. Yes, true. Inside the facility, the conduit opens and holds. The Enterprise, now flying over New York and engaged in a battle with the squadron, is about 1 kilometer out. Vosk gets on the platform and enters the conduit. Malcolm shoots at the building, and the Enterprise then flies by. Vosk screams in a very Hollywood-ish, no! And then we don't know if he actually dies, but because everything turns... how can I describe that? It's a
wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey, as other time-based BBC dramas
okay.
describe.
What they've said. And then there's Daniels, who's not really dead after all. And there's Archer. Daniel says that he did it. Vosk is dead. He never got back to his own timeline. The current timeline is restoring itself. Archer tells Daniel that he doesn't want to deal with him anymore. He just wants to go back home. Daniels disappear and Archer is back on the bridge. On the Enterprise's screen, we can see the Earth. Hoshi picks up multiple signals from Earth and Tipol detects dozens of ships coming towards them. Archer asks if they look friendly, and the episode ends on a view of the Enterprise surrounded by friendly Terran and Vulcan spaceships.
I am so disappointed by that last scene sequence because it just happened so quickly. It's almost as though they thought, okay, we've kind of done it. We've spent, 90% of the episode. We've still got the credits to roll yet, so take a bit off of that as well. We've got a little bit of time here. What can we do? Oh, we'll just do a feel good scene at the very end. And it's so disappointing. They did exactly the same at the end of Generations, yeah. When the Enterprise saucer landed on that planet beginning with the letter V. I can't remember it now. And at the very end of it, they did this very short feel-good segment, and then it was over. And I was so disappointed that they just, everything's fine, and back to normal again. Credits.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, also, I don't even like the fact that the way they did the ending of that scene was like, hey, there's these ships coming. Why?
Yeah. well, I thought, why are those ships coming? Well, you have to remember that the whole third season, the Enterprise was in the Expanse. So they probably think that the Enterprise just got out of the Expanse because, of course, they don't have any idea about the timeline and the time travel.
Well, I think the speed of what happened is probably the most annoying. I agree.
Yeah.
But it's because there's a ship that comes out of nowhere seemingly because of the time jump. And yeah. And then all of a sudden, they already have dozens of ships coming after them,
Yeah,
or that. And then they realize who it is, and they're like, oh, okay. But why would there be that many ships within 5 seconds to greet anyone?
Am I right in thinking that during the time they were in the Expanse, they were uncontactable by Starfleet?
Not completely, but they had communication issues, but occasionally there was some times.
Right, so them appearing out of the Expanse, and we're presuming here that they have actually landed back at the same point in time that they would have been at had they just left the Expanse as normal and not at some other time. Because I know that if I'm watching a TV program at the moment called Manifest, where an aeroplane went missing for 5.5 years and then suddenly landed as if nothing had changed, and of course 5.5 years has passed, but... Mm-hmm. If the Enterprise had suddenly appeared after however many, we don't know how long, years they'd spent in the Expanse, and then suddenly appeared out the other end of it, then they wouldn't necessarily have a huge number of ships flying towards them, I suppose, welcoming them home necessarily, because they've just been on a mission, same as any other mission. But had they not arrived at the same point they would have been at had they just left the Expanse, it could have been, I don't know, 5 years later. Right. Then what you would have expected is a semi-hostile response because the Enterprise has just come out of nowhere. No one's expecting it. As far as they're concerned, it was missing in action.
It could have been the Enterprise, but they'd taken over by a whole other race or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's another good example. It's all part of the Rush thing. It just doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, but there are other things that don't make sense to me for the end of this episode. First off, a ship the size of the Enterprise cannot enter the atmosphere. It would just crumble on under its own weight. It's not possible for a ship that size to get in the atmosphere. That's the reason why they build them in space. So that's my first point. Second point, even if a ship like that could get into the atmosphere, it cannot fly. Ships don't fly. They just float in space because there's no gravity. So that's my second point. Third point, T'Pol asked Travis to fly at 200 kph, 200 kilometers per hour. And when when they arrive over New York, Malcolm said, oh, we're just 1 kilometer out. If you're 1 kilometer out flying at 200 kilometers per hour, you better hurry shooting that.
You've already gone past it by now.
Yeah.
You've already crashed into it.
Yeah, so that's another point. Another point that I noticed is that the Enterprise looks really small in this scene where compared to the bombers. I mean, the bridge is not that big, but there's lots of things around that. There's lots of corridors, there's lots of rooms. You could probably fit one or two bombers inside the engine room.
It feels like someone thought about what they were doing and then kind of like made a solution that was not a good solution, where they were like, hey, this can't get into the atmosphere. What if it's smaller?
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe it's a side effect of the, you know, the conduit that, yeah. I don't know, but
we could also talk about like just the entire concept of the temporal Cold War in the first place.
Yeah, but let's agree on the fact that, you know, we don't agree. Have you about that.
Yeah. I like this episode because it ended that.
Yeah.
It's like, good. Let's just end this. Thank you.
Yeah. Come back on what Dave said. The Enterprise just got out of the expanse. So that's 3 years since the Enterprise left Earth the first time. Mm-hmm. At that time, they didn't have a lot of ships. I mean, except for the Enterprise, I'm not even sure they had any other ship.
I think the ships that were there were not Federation. They were like Vulcan ships and stuff.
Really?
Dorian ships. I don't think they actually had any Earth ships.
Yeah. So I hope so, because, I mean, Earth didn't have time or resources because the Federation doesn't exist yet. So they're probably still using, there's probably still countries on Earth and they are using money and things like that. It's not the Federation time where there's the one planet. And
I actually had to catch myself from saying Federation ships. I was like, that's not a thing.
There was no Federation.
apart from the end of this episode, I liked it. I liked it a lot. It was the going back and forth from the bridge and the Earth going, you know, the switching going faster and faster. It really brought something to the whole story. And
I think overall the episode was really good. There were certain things that I'm like, nah, that's weird. Why'd you do that? But for the most part, I think it was a pretty good episode. I think the parts where they're in the 40s and on the streets and having conversations with people in that time period are the most fun. But I think that the whole thing was good, especially with the way they managed the time of when going back and forth from the ship to the Earth, and then when it gets to the end, like you said, it starts getting faster in that pace, so they can show you the urgency of it. I think that's what was well done. I don't like the fact that Silic died, not because I have care that he died, that doesn't matter, but the fact that he died and then the timelines reset, he's not dead anymore.
Yeah.
if Daniels is dead, it comes back, and he died way before, there's no reason for Silic to be dead. But in like, if you look at the like the Wikia or whatever, he does die from that, which makes no sense.
Well, it's always a problem with time travel. This thing, it cannot be done right. There's no way.
I mean, I don't like the fact that they even did time travel in the first place, but yeah. At least attempt to kind of make some things make sense. Of like, I understand that they're doing like hand wavy stuff of like the timeline resets itself, however that makes any sense. But if one person's going to come back and randomly appear again, why can't another one do that too? And I understand why Voss can't, because he's standing inside of the conduit or whatever they're supposed to be calling that. He's standing inside of it, and when it explodes. Okay, that makes sense that he wouldn't be able to come back. But Silic, there's no reason why he wouldn't be coming back.
I thought from a storytelling perspective, I'm a huge fan of storytelling. And the fact that you really got into the character side of the series, it wasn't just, I think I used the phrase last week, actually, the Monster of the Week episode. It wasn't just about the baddie. It was about the characters, not just the Enterprise characters as well as the characters that that are specific to this this pair of episodes. But yeah, I think that the storytelling was pretty much spot on.
Yeah, I like how they kind of like the first episode they were just you had two bad guys, they were teaming up, and this one they're kind of like showing how like they were setting the stage for the eventual falling out of that. And I like how they promote how they situated it, so like the guy who. Like they had that where the Germans thought that they had more power than they actually did, and Voss just the way that he kills the German general is just like with like 3 seconds of time in the show. It's like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Right. So that ends the review for Star Trek Enterprise Stormfront Part 2. So now we have a guest, so we're going to chat with you, Michael.
Alrighty.
So just to be clear, when Dave and I talked about getting guests on this show, of course, nobody knocked on our door and said, hey, I want to come on your show. But I know Michael, and people who know Michael know me probably from the shows that I mentioned at the beginning of this episode. So I asked Michael, hey, would you like to come and be the first guest on this show? And we don't know what we're doing, and it's probably not going to be that good. And Michael said, yes, of course.
Well, actually, I said, fantastic. I like being an experiment.
Yes. So thank you very science. Much, Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I'm glad to be here.
So I know that you're a big Star Trek fan, but how long have you been a Star Trek fan? Since the beginning? Or is there a point in time where you suddenly discovered Star Trek and it was a love?
Well, it was definitely the beginning, but it was the beginning of my existence when I could remember things. So I started watching TNG when I was about 5, I think. And it was fun. And it was still on the air at the time. And I didn't understand what was going on, obviously. But I kept watching it because it was fun. And I just like sci-fi. And then Deep Space Nine came on, and I was like, man, this is boring. And then kind of branched out and started watching other sci-fi stuff. But I pretty much from the beginning, I enjoyed watching Star Trek. And then when I got to teenager era, I went back and watched some other episodes. And then I enjoyed Deep Space Nine more, and I enjoyed TNG more. And then I got to being an adult, going back and watching Deep Space Nine, and loved it. Like TNG is still my favorite, but I think Deep Space Nine is underrated by a lot of people because it has such a vast dynamic story that like pays off in every aspect that they set up. And like they have Monster of the Week stuff, but they actually have a multifaceted story that lasts for 7 years. And they pay off every branch that they set up eventually is paid off in the show. And I think that's, you know, a fantastic way of doing it. So that's why I put it in a higher level.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I believe, to me, Deep Space Nine is probably before the Next Gen in my top list. Sorry.
You mean higher? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I believe it's better, yeah.
I think it is definitely a contender for that. I wouldn't have a problem with that being put there. I think I have a nostalgic aspect of TNG because I enjoyed it immensely, of course, but it was more of a fun show rather than a fully dynamic, like well thought out show like the Deep Space Nine was. But also they had the benefit of TNG already existing, and they already had the ability to prove to the, you know, to the mainstream that this show could be good and this franchise could be good again, and that they wanted that, so they could do more and they could try out more things. So I think that they had that benefit that TNG didn't.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm saying it just makes sense that they'd be more willing to do something and that's more risky than, you know, just a sci-fi show.
Yeah, and I believe that the fact that it's on the space station, it's a close environment. They had, they didn't have to spend time and resources inventing planets or sculptures, so they had time to concentrate on the characters. And yeah, like you said, that's it's almost a 7-year development for every character in the series, and the relationship between the characters evolves during the whole series, and it's what makes me think it's just a notch better than Next Gen.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I'm just sitting here nodding and smiling because the Deep Space Nine was just one of the series I could not get into when it first came out, that is.
Right. When it first came out, I definitely agree with that.
I am going to revisit it. I have committed to do that. But I don't know. At the time, I just couldn't get into it.
Well, I'd like to come back when you do another Deep Space, when you do Deep Space Nine stuff, because that's definitely a thing that I very much enjoy that series of the franchise.
I think inevitably we will do.
Yeah.
Yes.
You should definitely do some stuff like that. And I think that Deep Space Nine it'll show you that, like, once you're in you're older, it's really meant for an older audience.
Yeah, because, I agree.
Like, it's even the topic of it basically being about the Holocaust, not really basically. I mean, it's pretty much a direct analogy. And it's a very interesting aspect because it's kind of like, what would happen if the leader of such a horrible period of time doesn't, you know, in themselves and decides that, what if I could try to make them like me? Like, that concept is just, it's such a great facet of the show, even though that's not really the main point of the show. It's every time the character shows up, you're like, this is going to be an interesting episode. So I think Deep Space Nine, like, has this weird thing where in the beginning, it feels a little boring. And I had some people tell me that they didn't like it because, like Ryan from Destination Linux, he said he didn't like it because it didn't get good until the Dominion came in, like, the later seasons. And I think that, like, it's actually not that way because it's definitely the storytelling aspects of Deep Space Nine that makes it good. Like, it's almost 80% storytelling with some action thrown in here and there for the first couple seasons. But they start introducing the Dominion in season 2, I think. And then they start giving you more details in, like, later season 2 or season 3. And then I think it's because of, if you're a fan of storytelling, I think that you will like Deep Space Nine now, watching it from this perspective.
Yeah, I totally agree. I have nothing more to say about that. It's spot on.
You've effectively made me contradict myself. By me saying how much I enjoy the storytelling aspect of television programs, to then say, "Oh, DS9 is all about storytelling." Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Now, really, you should I agree that the pilot was not maybe not the best pilot in the Star Trek series. It's but
wasn't the worst for sure.
Yeah. I believe Encounter at 4 point. I watch every time I watch it, I say, I have to go through this again.
Well, I actually kind of like the fact that the pilot has the interaction between Picard and Sisko, because they're showing you like how different these two people are, and how like one character has been the, you know, the epitome of a fantastic, a perfect captain, basically, and the epitome of like a good human being and all that stuff. And then the beginning of the next series, they vilify that character in the eyes of the new captain or new commander, essentially, at that time. And I think that's such an interesting and risky move that it, even if the pilot is not that good or that well acted and kind of a little bit campy, the fact that they would even do that makes me like it all the more.
Yeah, and also in this series, what I like is that you can you find characters that we're used to, like O'Brien and Worf when they join Star Trek, and that gives a sense of continuity between the Next Gen and Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Because it would have been really easy for them to say, okay, we're going to do Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek thing, but it's completely different, separate from Next Gen. But there's interaction between the two series, and I like that.
Yeah, I like having the crossovers. They don't do the crossovers that much, but I do like the fact that they did that, and I do like the O'Brien being taken from, you know, being a character on Next Gen, but not really that important of a character, to then now becoming like a very important character to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah,
and in later seasons even more so. So I think that it's pretty awesome that that the way they handled the transition, even if the people a part of both shows didn't really like that transition, I think that the way they did it was good.
Yeah, I agree. Dave, do you have any question for our guest?
Not specifically. I think I was going to ask more questions about your other elements of podcasting rather than Star Trek.
Okay. But before we move into that,
yeah,
I just want to bring up one thing. Enterprise is a show that I like. Overall, I don't like every episode. I don't like the temporal thing, but maybe it's just me, but I absolutely hate the intro music.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Okay.
It's so out of place.
Yeah, every time it starts, it's like, oh, this again.
I mean, the music itself is not, you know, it's not.
Yeah, it's mediocre. It's okay, but it has nothing to do. It does not fit in any way whatsoever. It makes me feel like I'm watching Knight Rider or something.
Something like that, yes.
or maybe even like Full House. Like, it's that kind of music. It's like, what is this?
Yeah, what went through their mind when they decided that, you know, they're going to drop the space opera music with and replace it with a song.
It's like all this, every other series has a good, like, it gives you the gravity of what is happening in this show and like how important it is. And then they're like, hey, soft rock. Okay. It's like, no, thank you.
Please, it's not just the theme music though. It's the opening sequence in its entirety is so far away from everything else that Star Trek has ever done.
Oh yeah.
And in fact, now while we're talking about the theme music, let's talk about what they did in season two, because in season one it was the soft rock, and then in season two they turned it into this upbeat poppy. It was awful. It was even worse.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I quite appreciated the soft rock element of the first theme tune. But then they put a much more upbeat, double time rhythm to it. And yeah, if it was bad before.
Yeah, it was atrocious at that point.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but it's not even that it didn't. It's that it didn't. It's the fact that it didn't fit so much, and that they didn't. And the fact that the fans were so adamant, like, stop it. They had plenty of time in future seasons to just go back to the space opera aspect.
Mm.
And they never thought, like, well, this is not important enough. Like, it's every single time, like, when I was watching on TV, I would actually sometimes consider, like, 50-50, whether I would turn off the channel or change the channel just because that music is playing and doesn't even, like, they don't even understand their own series kind of thing. and or I would suffer through it. Now that I'm watching it on Netflix, I can skip the intro.
Skip
every time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh yes.
Which is like the most beautiful thing ever. Like, yeah. I really can't stand, like, I think the only thing I can't stand about Enterprise is that stuff, is the, like, the not really important to the stories that are just kind of like a separate thing. Like the temporal thing, I don't like it, but I don't really care that much either. It's not that big of a deal. It's like, there's no way to make time travel really make much sense because, you know, just inherently. So I think that the way they did it, like, and they, you know, did hand-wavy stuff, it's like, yeah, I kind of expected that anyway.
It's almost like the way it doesn't automatically link into the original series. Now, obviously, the series Enterprise is supposed to be immediately before... Or not immediately before, but, you know, reasonably before the original series was originally determined to be set. But there are lots of things that have happened in Enterprise that never were mentioned in the original series.
Yeah.
And I would have expected at least some of them. Certainly some of the big things, like the Zindi conflict, I don't recall that ever being mentioned in the original series.
Yeah. The sad thing is that when you make a prequel, you kind of have to either... ignore the thing that you're making a prequel of mostly, or try to fit things inside of it.
But, like they have with Discovery.
Yes. Yes. And isn't Discovery like a pre-sequel sort of in between thing?
Discovery is between Enterprise and the original series. Yeah.
Okay. So I think that also how much like the time between Enterprise and the original series.
I can answer that question if you start talking about something else.
All right. But I think Enterprise is actually a pretty good show, and I do like... I think the way I look at this show is that 90% of the show is good, and then it just falls apart at some point. Like, most episodes are even like that.
I believe the third season was, I believe, what killed the series, because the whole Expanse thing... I mean, okay, do 2, 3, 4, 5 episodes if you want, but 24 episodes of that. And to come back to the Zindi conflict not being mentioned on the original series, that happened in the third season in The Expanse. So we don't know yet what Archer reported to Starfleet Command.
But the Zindi stuff. So. But they're aware of the Zindi stuff. Like, because there's people who mention the Zindi stuff in the show that are on Earth. There are people on Earth talking about the Zindi stuff.
Okay, so I missed that.
Yeah, and it's not, they just mention it in one sentence. Like, well, we're worried about the Zindis coming back or something. And that's like the only amount of effort they put into that part. But if something that's that big, not being, like, being a part of, like, the prequel to, like, the, it doesn't really make sense. But, they can kind of, I guess they can kind of get away with it by saying that it's a different timeline because they did so much of that stuff.
Or they can do what they did at the end of season 2 of Discovery, is that nobody should be allowed to talk about that. Beam.
Yeah, that seemed a bit weak.
Yeah,
to me.
But yeah,
I mean, I like Discovery as a separate show. I don't like it as a...
Well, it is now.
Well, I mean, I don't like it as a... I like it as a separate show that's not put in that timeline. Putting it in that timeline, I don't like. Like, I wish they would have just done the same thing. Because they could have done basically the same story and not put it in that timeline period. Because I don't like the fact that there's a ship that has such a massive power that is by itself able to win every conflict. Yet... it never happened anywhere in any other franchises, like any of the other series. I mean,
but that's what I'm saying. The fact that they've effectively blocked any memory of it by swearing the crew of both the Discovery and the Enterprise at that time that what happened in season 2 of Discovery, didn't.
Did they actually remove the memories from them?
No, they didn't. It was a Pike, before he left Discovery, to take the Enterprise back, effectively said, you know, we never talk of this. This never happened.
Yeah, but you if they don't actually, because there's some parts where they, in a future series where they erase memories and change memories and stuff. If they had done that, okay, I guess. But in this, say, don't talk about it. There's a guarantee that some random, you know, ensign or whatever is going to say something. Like, it's just going to happen. And I just don't think that that's a way to completely solidify that they don't talk about it, just because there's very unlikelihood that someone will not want to talk about it. Because you can get people to talk about stuff that's super important that you don't want to tell. And the only way to keep a secret is if the only one person knowing that secret.
Yes. And keeping it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, we don't know what's going to happen in season 3. Maybe Discovery doesn't have the spot drive anymore. We don't know.
It's possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We don't know what damage the jump would have inflicted on the ship itself.
Let's talk about their not Klingons. They don't look like Klingons, but every other aspect is really done well for the Klingon ass part of it. I don't like the fact that they don't look like Klingons at all, and it's weird.
Well,
it's a prequel. It doesn't make sense. Like it makes sense. Like they explain why the ridges were created to the Klingons, but when the original series didn't have the ridges, but the it seems weirder that that's in between the two.
Yeah.
Because, like, the difference between the ridges and the non-ridges are not that much different. Like, it's a reasonable genetic change, whereas this one is a massive genetic change that makes no sense. Like, why would it go from that part to that part?
If you look at the next generation class of Klingons, actually, they don't look that dissimilar to humans in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
But with, and that was mid-90s, wasn't it? So if you're looking at the Discovery version of the Klingons, you've got 20 plus years of CG, of makeup, of creative evolution.
Right.
To try and make the Klingon race actually look like probably what it should have done in the first place, which is an absolutely vicious looking bunch of creatures.
I agree, but it's a prequel. So
yeah, that's right. Okay. But
continuity wise, it makes no sense at all.
No, but that doesn't work. You can't do that because in 1966, when the original series was 66, so I'm actually looking at it. It's right in front of me. In 1966, when the original series was first released, if you look at the technology that was used, let's say, on the bridge, for example, versus what was on the bridge of the Discovery at the end. In fact, even the bridge of Enterprise. That was 2001. 2001. Yeah, 2001. The first season of Enterprise. You can't apply the rules of continuity based on the fact that these were created in different times.
I think you can, because the way that Enterprise did it was well done, because they did it they took into consideration this is the first ever ship, so there's not going to be, you know, on screen buttons everywhere. It's not going to be like a touchscreen L-Cars thing. It's mostly like mechanical levers and that kind of thing.
Granted, I mean, mostly that came out in TNG was all the technical aspect of things.
Right. Well, it went from being with Enterprise, it was like pull levers and very mechanical thing, then to Star Trek original series where it's mostly button stuff, and then to TNG where it's more touchscreen. And I think they did that well. I think there's other things that they didn't do the prequel part. They didn't continuity well, but they didn't change a race so drastically that it doesn't make sense. Like, that's the only part that, like, no other character, like, they created characters in Enterprise that they wanted to do, that they didn't make a whole, they didn't try to change something, they just made a new race. And I think that's a reasonable approach, because with the Klingons, they already had multiple series where they look like Klingons, where like TNG and Deep Space Nine definitively shows this is what they look like. And yes, they didn't have the technology, but they also should have respect to the franchise that they're working with and making that particular that look of a species just look cooler and look more well done with the new makeup work they could do and that kind of thing, rather than completely changing everything about them. Because they don't look like Klingons at all. I do like the fact that they speak in Klingon most of the time when they're together, and they only make references like to like phrases that the Federation say and stuff like that. I like that part, but they don't look anything like Klingons, like even at all. Like maybe like their forehead has ridges and that's it. But there's such a drastic difference. I don't think that it makes sense for them to do that, because even Deep Space Nine recognized, like, you know, people realized there was a difference between Klingons in the original series and TNG. They never really acknowledged it. And then in Deep Space Nine, there's an episode where they actually show Worf in the same room with, like, the time travel episode where the same room of the original series Klingons. And everybody's shocked, like, what happened? And Worf is like, we don't talk about it.
Yeah, I like this scene on this episode.
That was a fantastic scene, because like they acknowledge that there's a difference, but that difference is not so drastic where they look like a completely different species. And I think that the one in Discovery looks like a whole different species.
Maybe it's not the same breed of Klingons, or you know, maybe something is going to happen. I mean, they have the ability to turn a Klingon into a human. They did that with...
With Folk.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe maybe at some point there's a genetical experiment that goes wrong. And
Well, they explained the original series to the TNG Klingons was a virus that genetically altered them.
So, maybe they're going to come up with something, you know, like a Hollywood way to explain things.
You seem to be using that phrase a lot recently, Yannick.
Yeah.
Universal translators. That's how they speak English.
Yeah. I mean, it's just natural that an alien and a German officer speak English. I mean,
yes, for no apparent reason.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I want to offer a correction. My knowledge of the Star Trek timeline has basically left me completely, because I've made a number of mistakes in this episode about the timeline. The question was asked how far between Enterprise and the original series. The end of Enterprise was 2155, and the beginning of Star Trek, the original series, was 2266. So that's 111 years between the two. Discovery was 2256, so 10 years before the original series. That makes more sense to me. I think I also said that TNG was mid-90s. It wasn't. It was mid-80s, mid-late 80s.
Yeah. Deep Space Nine was mid-90s.
Yeah. I didn't actually realize there was that much of a timeline crossover between TNG, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager.
2 years each time.
Yes. No.
Yeah.
No, the overlap between Deep Space Nine and Voyager, according to this, was 5 years.
What?
So Deep Space Nine was 20... no, I'm talking about the timeline, not the years between them.
He's talking about the continuity timeline.
Yeah, the timeline, 2369 was Deep Space Nine, and 2371 was Voyager. So two years later, and the timelines operated in parallel.
I was convinced that Voyager started at the beginning of season 5 of Deep Space Nine.
It says here season 3.
Okay.
And it looks like they didn't just mimic the universe timeline. They also came out in the same year.
Yes. Yes.
That does explain a lot, because they were pushing Voyager so much. They wanted to have another, like what, season three? So that had two seasons where people were like, oh, Deep Space Nine is not doing anything because they're in a space station. So we got to make a new show that has a ship that's going out and doing things and all this other stuff. And I think they pushed it out too quickly, and that's why Voyager's terrible.
Yeah, they pushed it so quickly that they didn't think about...
They had no plot idea whatsoever.
every episode, they changed her hair. ridiculous.
I mean, actually, kind of funny because they changed Kira's hair from this first episode of Deep Space Nine to the second episode. Yeah. And when I went back and watched it, this recent time, I was like, I don't remember her hair being that awful. And then the next episode comes like, oh, okay, they did it really quickly. That makes sense. But the Voyager makes sense because they did it so quickly. They just didn't have a plot. They didn't have characters developed. They didn't have a story. Apparently they didn't have writers. That makes sense now.
Yeah. So send the ship far away so it doesn't interact with the other series, and we're good.
Yeah. And also that we don't have to worry about whether or not the characters make any sense and have any, like, they did have one character that did come from TNG, sort of. I mean, not counting Barclay. I'm talking about a main character that came from TNG, sort of. Like, not really, but kinda. Because Tom Paris was in a training, academy training thing with Wesley Crusher.
Oh,
not the same character, not the same actor or anything, but like just the character itself was in that. And then all of a sudden they kind of were like, oh, okay, I kind of get there's a little bit of a connection, but you know, they found the most obscure connection they possibly could have. And that's what they chose.
Yeah. And once again, the pilot of Voyager was really something you had to endure.
No. Voyager itself is something you had to endure. Yeah. Like, just every single episode is like just painful. Like they created two characters that anybody should care about, and that's the Doctor and Seven of Nine. Beyond that, it's like, eh. We could go into the huge tangent about how awful Voyager is, but I don't want to. That'd be an extra hour.
We might have to invite him back, Yannick.
Yes. Michael, you already said you want to come back for Deep Space Nine, but you will come back also for Voyager.
I would love to come back and talk about Voyager. Absolutely. Not just the things, like I'll come back with a top 10 list. Here's the top 10 reasons why Voyager is the worst of all Star Trek.
Yeah, we can do an episode like that. And I'm sure we're going to have some listeners. Top 10 reasons why you should not watch Voyager.
Exactly.
You'll get all of them. I think you'll get opinions across all of the various series and,
oh, yes, of course,
and films and timeline series blocks.
Like, I think every single series has some merit except for Voyager. Unless you count, and like, except for maybe the one good episode of maybe there was two. That Q was on Voyager, and then that's a good episode.
Hi, Dave, you had some question for Michael.
I was just going to ask some fairly mundane and boring questions about your podcasting history. Yannick's already mentioned that you do two main podcasts, Tux Digital and Destination Linux. When was your first foray into podcasting? What was the first thing you did?
Oh, technically, as far as being hosting, that it was This Week in Linux was the first thing I did on Tux Digital, and that was 2 years ago, I think. The first time I got into podcasting at all was 2012, I think. Might have been 2011. I'm not sure. One of the two. I started being a producer for the Linux Action Show and Linux Unplugged on Jupiter Broadcasting Network.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Okay.
That's when I started doing podcasting stuff and when I started getting interested in it. And eventually I decided to branch off and make my own content that wouldn't really fit with the JB network. So I created Tux Digital and then created the This Week in Linux podcast. And from there, I joined the Destination Linux podcast. They just asked me to do it. And I was like, you know what? Sure, why not? You can never have too many podcasts. That's not true. You can totally have too many. And then I started guest hosting on other podcasts like Floss Weekly on the Twit Network. I occasionally guest host there. And I started doing like, you know, as many guest spots as possible on any podcast that would have me. Because I just enjoy podcasts, especially when it's topics that I'm a fan of, like Linux or Star Trek. So I'm happy to be here as for that. And anytime you'd want me to come back, I would love to.
We will ask you back.
When you were with Jupiter Broadcasting, was that just as a producer?
Mostly, yes. I did producing and like at sysadmin stuff, that kind of thing. But I didn't do any hosting on any of the JB Network stuff. That's why a lot of people, I mean, technically I was a part of the Linux Unplugged show occasionally where I would talk, but I was never a host of any of the shows. So people never, like I was never on the Linux Action show, so people wouldn't see what I looked like. So when I started doing podcasting on my own, there was no transition from people knowing me on this other thing into the other thing. I had to build everything from scratch. And occasionally, people would comment on my videos, like say, your voice sounds familiar. Have you ever been on Unplugged?
Gotcha.
Yeah. So that kind of thing happens, but that's a very rare thing.
Right. Just a cheeky question, really. Is This Week in Linux anything to do with Twit?
No.
No.
No. The name is basically an homage, I guess, to This Week in Tech, but it's not related to Twit at all. I just decided to name it that way because I wanted to do a weekly news show and Linux Weekly News didn't have a ring to it. So I liked This Week in Linux is just, it just felt right. So that's why I picked it.
No, that's fair enough. I mean, there are a number of podcasts that are This Week in something that aren't related to the Twit network. I wasn't sure whether yours was one of them.
Right. I would love to do something with the Twit network. That would be amazing. And beyond the co-hosting, like, you know, I enjoy doing the co-hosting of Floss Weekly. But if there is, you know, other things that I could get to do, I would love to do that as well. But it's really fun to do Floss Weekly as well, just to see how they do their podcasting and in comparison to what I do. Much, much more professional. They are, by the way, be clear about that. A much more professional experience to see that.
That was actually going to be my next question. Are you a professional podcaster? Is that how you live?
No, not exactly. I mean, I do have I put a lot of time into my podcasting. So the amount of work I put into it, you could say it's full time, but I also, I'm a designer and a marketer. So I do design work and graphic design stuff and user experience for software in some cases. And I do marketing for businesses and help them with the SEO and that kind of thing. So like, you know, just in general, I help do business to business stuff to help other companies get to the, you know, places they want to be and the size they want to be with the recognition they want. But as far as like what I want to do, I would say that podcasting is Linux is my number one passion, but I'd say podcasting comes pretty close second. And I would love to make my podcasting career an actual career. So that is the goal, but at the moment that's not the reality yet.
What's your opinion on suggestions that have been made, certainly that I've heard, that podcasting isn't a career in its own right, that you could only do podcasting or make money out of podcasting as part of another industry?
I don't think that that's necessary. I mean, I think that's completely not true at all. There's a lot of people who would just do podcasting. And I guess you could say in a sense that it's not like they're selling the podcast and that's what they mean. Because every time I've talked to any podcasters who are professional podcasters, they're also doing other things. And it's just because they want to do things. They want to do as many things as possible. And I fit in that as well. I don't want to do just podcasting. I want to do podcasting as well as I design my own merch and that kind of thing just because I like design. So I, you know, do that as a side thing that I want to do. So it depends on how they interpret a full-time podcaster. If they mean that you're doing only podcasting and nothing else, I think it's still possible because of the sponsorship deals you could get.
Yeah.
It would take a long time to get to the size and the amount of effort it would take to get there that it's not practical for most people. But once you get to that size, I think that because of sponsorship deals and stuff, that it totally could be a full-time. And it definitely is a career for sure, because there's many people who have proven that.
Yeah, well, there's one person in my mind particularly that's gone full-time in podcasting. Just happens to work for Jupiter Broadcasting. I've not personally heard of anyone apart from Joe Ressington that is actually a full-time podcaster, and that is what they do.
Well, that's in the terms of the Jupiter Broadcasting. It's more of like Linux Academy is funding everything, so even then, it's kind of like Linux Academy makes the money from the services they offer.
Yeah,
that makes it possible. But if you didn't have a financial backer, I don't think that'd be practical to say. Like to do like no. unless you have like unless you've been doing it for years and you've built up an audience that it makes the sponsor care, I think that would be a possibility to make it full time even then. But in the case of Jupiter Broadcasting, if you have a financial backer, it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, no, I get that. I pitched an idea to Yannick earlier this week that we should do a pop quiz, quick fire. Questions, and I've come up with a list of six so far. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a series of questions. There are only six to ask, but they are quick fire, so don't think about them. And it should be basically a one or two word answer.
Okay.
So, in terms of Star Trek, what's your favorite series?
TNG very closely next to DS9.
Okay. Favorite film?
I don't think... I can't remember the name. I'd say probably Wrath of Khan. Because I was gonna say maybe the... I can't remember the name. It was like the Returned Country something. I don't know.
The Undiscovered Country.
Yeah, yeah.
The one with David Warner and Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably number two.
Okay. Favorite ship?
I could just cheat and say Enterprise because that covers some.
Which one?
Oh, dang it. I think the most... well, actually, you could say does it count if because you can't even say the original series unless you're talking about the TV show versus the movie because they have two different... entirely different Enterprises.
Yeah,
themselves.
It was the Enterprise and the Enterprise Alpha, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I don't know. I think the thing I'd want to live on, if I had to choose, it would probably be the next gen Enterprise because there's
that
less,
was wasn't it? Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. There's less likelihood that you're going to like if you were just a citizen and you didn't actually like be a part of Federation, that'd be more enjoyable because you have the hollow,
yeah.
The hollow, what are they?
Holodecks.
Holodeck.
Okay. I always say hollow suite because of the DS9 thing.
Yeah.
I think that's more likely because, and also that if you're not, and even if you worked for Picard, you're less likely to die just because of the color of your shirt. So.
Excellent. I would have said that my favorite ship was the Orville, but I might get kicked off here.
I do like the Orville. I actually do like that show.
We should talk about that in another episode because I think it really is a good series.
For sure.
Right, favorite captain.
Actually, it's Picard is my favorite captain in this. Well, no, I'm gonna go Sisko. I think he's my favorite captain just because he's more realistic. But I think TNG Picard is the better captain. I just think Sisko is more real, so I'd go with him.
Okay. Favorite character?
Since that's the question that's right after the captain, I'm going to switch it, say Picard, favorite captain, favorite character, Sisko. Just because I think his development is so interesting that he has especially the fact that he goes from being like the commander and then the captain and then goes into the situation where he does things that are not representative of a captain but then you agree with the fact that he's doing it because he has to, and he's willing to take hard decision to do so. I like that.
And final one, favorite storyline. Now, this can be an arc, it could be an episode, or it could be a segment taken from a film.
Oh, okay. Naturally, it's when Voyager goes warp 10, they turn lizards. That's definitely not true. That's the best example of why that show's awful. I guess my favorite storyline is just essentially the. Can I have two?
Yeah.
Okay. The first one would be Q is my favorite. Has this favorite storylines because he has all these different intermixing storylines that I'm very tempted to call him my favorite character too, but he doesn't have that much impact on the franchise, even though he does, you know, have a ton of impact. I think that most of the stories with him, but my favorite story with him would be him turning human and having to experience the part of being human, and then connect that with the overall story of DS9 with the Dominion and everything. Because I think that's because DS9's story is so vast, it's hard to pick individual pieces. So I would go with I would cheat and just say the whole thing.
I suppose we can allow that. It's an arc, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is an arc.
7-year long arc, but it's an arc.
But I did say one. I did get one episode, so you know, the Q human thing. So at least there's. I didn't cop out completely. I chose a whole series and two different ones. So
excellent, Yannick. Have you got any more questions to ask off the back of that?
No, I
would imagine this list will start to grow over time. But I think six questions is a good number.
Yeah.
Here's one for you guys. A favorite villain of Star Trek.
Oh.
Wow.
I was going to say Q because it's not really enjoyable at the beginning. But it's one that you love to hate.
Yeah. He's not really even a villain. He's kind of he's an anti-hero sort of.
Yeah. So
like,
I'm going
He just likes to play with people. he's like these little toys.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Q.
Okay.
I am going to go. I'm going to get laughed at this, I'm sure, but I'm going to go with Soren.
Interesting.
From Generations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just think as a character, and obviously as a villain, he was very calculating. His intent was absolute, but his motives, they kind of made sense. He didn't actually set out to be. To kill loads of people. His intent was pure, but very, very, very selfish. But I thought as a character, he had a lot of character.
Interesting. In terms of character, I'd probably go with probably Khan. And then in terms of like a group villain, I was going to say the Dominion, but it has to be the Borg.
Oh, yeah.
How about this? The Borg before Voyager. Because I think the Voyager just ruined the Borg. They didn't really ruin it, but they used them so much that they became like kind of irrelevant. Like if you take the Wolf 359 scenario where there's like five ships against one cube and the cube destroys mostly everything and it takes all the effort of the Federation to fight them. And then the Voyager destroys four? No. This is... No. But I'll say that for the next time we talk about Voyager.
Yeah. And I guess we can add a seventh question to our list, then. best villain.
I already have.
Okay. Well done. Well done.
Nice.
Well, I think we're going to end this episode here. Once again, thanks a lot, Michael, for joining us. And,
absolutely. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and be sure that you will come back.
Hopefully.
Thanks to everyone who downloaded our previous episodes. We are really grateful. When we started this, we really thought that we were going to have like 3 downloads per episode. But nope, it's going up. Thanks a lot. Our podcast can be found everywhere fine podcasts are, including but not exclusively in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, etc., etc. Also, you can find, of course, every episode and all the information you need on our website at tallgreyhut.org. Please help us spread the word by sharing the show on social media, talking to a friend, and if you're so inclined, leave us a nice review in your podcast app. That can never do harm. Dave, how can people contact us?
Right, so you can reach us via email, that old-fashioned thing, the web 1.0. feedback@tallgreyhut.org is our email address. Now, as far as social media is concerned, we have a minor change to report. We used to have the tallgreyhut2 Twitter handle, because some nice person nicked tallgreyhut and we couldn't get in contact with them. But then Yannick came up with this wonderful idea. Well, let's get on Facebook as well. So we have aligned our Facebook and Twitter handles to TEGH Podcast. It's TEGH for tallgreyhut. So on Twitter, we are twitter.com/TEGH Podcast and Facebook.com/TEGH Podcast.
And if this is a bit complicated, you can go to tallgreyhut.org/Twitter or tallgreyhut.org/Facebook, and that will redirect you directly to the right page.
Exactly. And I'm pretty certain you can get to all of those directly from our website anyway.
Yes, of course. Unless otherwise stated, this episode is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution share-alike license, which means that you can pretty much do whatever you want with it as long as you credit us as the original author. And of course, if you use Michael's part, you have to credit Michael. And if you publish something based on this episode, you have to release it under the same license.
Right. I think that probably brings us to the end then. So
yes.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fantastic.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it.
We shall be back next week to review episode 3 of Star Trek Enterprise, the name of which escaped me for the moment.
me too. Sorry.
We should have had that.
It's called Home.
It's called Home. Right, I've got that. That makes perfect sense. So we'll be back to review that next week.
In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
See ya. You are listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find more of our shows at otherside.network.